Hello and welcome to episode 3 of the Newism podcast. The Newism's ambition is big. We want to create a new, more inclusive economic system fit for the modern world. Some of the world's most innovative and exciting minds are already creating solutions to fix our broken society, but they often have to do it in isolation and in spite of the current system. Each week, we invite social innovators and disruptors onto our podcast to discover how they would shape a new system if they were given a blank sheet of paper. Our only rule is that the conversation is constructive and positive. Our guest in this episode is Michael Sahni. Michael is the CEO and founder of Bite the Ballot, an organisation which empowers young people to engage in democracy and activism. From its beginnings as a school lunchtime club, Bite the Ballot has gone on to coordinate record-breaking campaigns, drive changes in the law, and rebrand politics for young people.
So, hi, Michael. It's really great to be here. So, I'm with Michael Sahni, who's founder of Bite the Ballot, a fantastic organisation, a fellow social entrepreneur. And we're here to talk about the Newism. And Michael knows that where we're coming from here is that, you know, the current economic system isn't really fit for purpose. The rich get rich, the poor get poorer, it's not sustainable, and we're looking for a new way forward. As part of that comes a set of values. What values do society care about? What are they? What's the most important thing in terms of how we live together? And it's obviously really relevant for an organisation like Bite the Ballot, who've been doing such great work over the years. So perhaps, Michael, I might just start asking you, tell me about Bite the Ballot. What's the organisation's purpose, and what have you been doing?
Well, ultimately, Mel, I think the purpose of Bite the Ballot is to try and give voice and give power to those most affected by injustice of the current political system, so that they use that power and use that voice collectively to influence it and change it. Because as with many areas in society, those most affected by problems are the least likely to be engaged in the shaping of the future policy, whether that's homelessness or youth engagement in politics. So for me, it's a similar narrative to the Newism in the respect that politics isn't working. It's self-serving, it's elitist. It's a lovely avenue for those that are already engaged to take the steps necessary to walk up to climb the ladder of power. And we seem to leave more and more people behind. And in fact, I feel as though our current politics is reliant on leaving those people behind, ensuring that they're, busy focusing on fear and division and never really looking up to see how they can challenge it. So I want to disrupt that. I want to reach those that are most furthest away from politics, those that are downtrodden, those that are forgotten, the disabled, the incarcerated, the homeless, the BME. And if you can bring those people together around issues or causes and they can understand the power they've got through that connection, then hopefully we start to disrupt the politics is normal that just seems to be constantly destroying the planet as we know it, communities as we know it, and any feel of society as we know it.
So how practically going about that then? I know you've been doing work around the world and so on. So how give me a couple of examples of how you're doing that.
Yeah, so I really, obviously a lot of it was learning by doing, definitely. I mean, I quit my job as a 27-year-old teacher who at that exact time had never been registered to vote and never voted. So I lost 9 years of influence just through the sheer nature of not believing it to be important or relevant, which felt too convenient at the time. And there was I was in fact the majority. None of my friends participated. So a lot of it was by doing, very solution focused, trying to bring primarily younger people together around an issue, and then demonstrating to them that those issues are political. And if you care about the issue, you are political, and politics is even better if you're involved. And I think when I reflect on the 8 years I've been doing this, really it boils down now to four steps. The first step is that initial engagement. The initial engagement needs to be provocative, so we'll run events in schools where, you know, it's experiential learning, but it ends with a call to action to register to vote. We'll be provocative online by taking content and trying to sort of, you know, push people's buttons in a way where we can bring them into the same environment to at least challenge them and get them to challenge each other. Outside of that initial engagement, I think a lot of work needs to then be done on opinion forming, sharing, comparing. The social media landscape lends itself nicely to reach people at scale, but you also then are open to people sitting behind the comforts of their smartphone and computer and sort of saying whatever they want without that natural respect. So the third step really is that face-to-face. So we reinvigorated the idea of the 17th century coffee house, where we bring people together in coffee shops and provide free refreshments. But whilst they're there, we've ensured that we brought different parts of the community together to just actually talk and listen and understand that we might care about the same issue but want a different outcome. So we sort of depolarise politics in those instances, and the feedback is amazing, and it's been that project that's gone around the world now. The last 3 months I've been in Colombia and France, not understood a word of what anyone's saying, but it's my methodology and it works, ensuring different people, key stakeholders around a particular issue are all there over coffee, hot chocolate, you name it, in a very sort of small, nicely crafted environment. But it's amazing because people enjoy being heard. And at these events, you move away from, you know, I'll just wait for the pause so I can start talking, but we actually listen to each other. And I think the thing that underpins all of it is then advocacy. So how do you take the data, how do you take your experiences and try and funnel it into the system to tackle the root causes of why your work exists in the first place? So trying to change laws and influence policy.
That's fascinating. And obviously you're the typical social entrepreneur, so you get it to work one place. Now you're trying to do it all over the world. And are you finding it, as you're moving around the world, the same issues there, exactly the same? People are excluded and want to feel part. Is that something you're finding?
Yes and no. I think in part, definitely the same issues arise, and there are parts of society that have almost been left behind. But it did give me, you know, I was quite depressed after I left Colombia because I came back to the UK and just realised how lucky we are in terms of, yeah, all right, the system has its flaws. It's mainly because of the people and the people's mindset. But, you know, in Colombia, these youngsters that live through war, parents being kidnapped and to never return, and I've got a chance now to influence politics, and there's energy there. I mean, they want it. Whereas in the UK, I've got to stoke people up. I've really got to push their buttons to even care. There, the enthusiasm and that hunger was there. And yet, they can't walk into Parliament whenever they want. They can't go and see their MP every week. They can't go to council consultations. They only ever see an elective representative when they come to their community and try and buy their vote with a piece of pork. But the enthusiasm to be part of that was one that I wish I could bottle up and sort of let loose on these collection of tiny little islands and just say, go on, run wild, because the biggest thing that's damaging here is apathy. Most people don't believe they can do anything, and so they don't try.
That's really fascinating. So what you have here is an established Western democracy, allegedly democracy, I use the words in inverted commas, and people not voting in it. Is that because actually we're quite stable, that there's a level of income or a level of wealth that make us feel well? I hear young people talk a lot, well, it doesn't matter who you vote for because there's no real difference in them. Is that what that's telling you, or are we just really becoming lazy and apathetic, and that's very worrying?
I think, you know, and not to overlook the poverty we have here, because we do, but not like there, definitely. You know, I mean, we are still, for all its flaws, if we are ill, we can go and receive medical help. But yes, we'll, and then complaining to us is, oh, the NHS doesn't work, I had to wait X many hours or days for an appointment. Whereas if you've you've got no money in places like Colombia, you're left to die. There is no reality. So that is the reality for them. So I think we are comfortable, but then I also think that amazingly and very cleverly, the vote has been made to feel worthless. Absolutely made to feel worthless, because we've got a media that will just sort of polarise every issue. It's who can shout the loudest. It's sort of headline grabbing rather than let's get into this and look at a solution. That puts so many young people off, and then we get things like, well, it's only me, nothing ever changes, when I think that's the very thing we've got to tackle, that idea of community and that idea of it's never just you. I might be gay, you might be straight, I might like a skateboard, you ride a bike, I listen to this music, you listen to that music, but if you care about this issue and I care about this issue, we're a lot stronger if we come together. And we haven't realised that here yet.
I think it's really interesting in terms of, would you say in terms of the UK, is it a democracy anymore? A lot of people after the end of the Second World War, it was very, very important that you had the vote, everybody had a vote, and that vote meant that you felt part of the decision-making process of the country. Here we are now in 2018, mm-hmm. and it seems that we're not connected with that. But then, you know, and people aren't voting. But then I might look at Australia and say, yeah, everybody has to vote there, it's the law. But then everyone seems to be very dissatisfied with the government that they've got, regardless of the fact that they all have to vote. Mm. Then you go to somewhere like, say, Switzerland, where you have cantons there, and they seem to have referendums 3-4 times a year when everyone votes on a particular issue of government. And then there's levels of dissatisfaction there. I'm wondering if we actually, if that we are moving into an age of post-democracy in a modern, connected world. What's your thoughts? Do we need to move into something completely new here?
Well, my gut feeling is yes. I think this is a farce of a democracy. I love it how we go to other countries and dictate that they must have a democracy, yet we gerrymander with the turnout figures here. We don't ensure everyone's educated. We don't ensure everyone's engaged. I mean, it's worse in America. We don't purposely move polling stations to block out Afro-Caribbean communities to vote. But we're going that way. We're following suit. We put so many barriers in place. And I don't truly believe we're a democracy, no.
So what we're trying to do is the difficult bit here in these discussions, as you know, is to try and say, okay, well, what does a fair system look like? If we're moving post-democracy, what does it look like? This country's relatively wealthy, you were saying, or it has wealth in it, maybe not evenly distributed, but people are expressing unhappiness in their lives, mental health statistics going up, so something's not right. So what is a system then, or what elements should there be in a system if we try and think about this constructively?
Well, for me, the starting point is that a country's, we need to move beyond measuring a country's wealth by its levels of GDP. Debt or GDP or whatever nonsense that is, because it doesn't work. You know, it would be amazing, and I know pockets of the world are doing this, but the value of a country being measured by how happy and healthy its people are. I mean, what an amazing starting point, because then the fundamentals that what get built around that are all based on those, and we see values like empathy and compassion being the fundamental drivers to ensure everyone is cared for. We face injustice and inequality head on to try and change it. Everything's a financial transaction here. It's, oh, it doesn't work, but it'll cost more to fix it, so just leave it. I mean, how can we ever fix things when that's the attitude?
So one part of this would be creating a new matrix of measures which become our barometer on a monthly basis rather than the FTSE index. Here's a new barometer that says how we're performing in terms of issues like happiness and compassion and so on.
Yeah, because then we can't avoid our most needed and most marginalised, because they are built into the equation. GDP it doesn't even matter because our most wealthiest and biggest companies are sort of flying the flag for us. And oh, if you've fallen off the cliff edge and, you know, there's no incentive for us to bring you in and contribute to that. So I think ultimately that new barometer, that new metric needs to be at the centre. And then for me, there's this idea of collective responsibility, which ultimately, you know, democracy on paper does lend itself to that. The idea that we're all involved, we're all engaged, we're all accountable, and then we lend our power to key people to act on our behalf. If we could ensure that was working, and we embraced technology to use that, and we divided responsibility to do that, then there's no reason why that couldn't work. But you know, we can't have this ongoing party whip culture where the party wants you to vote a certain way, so it doesn't matter what you think. It's just nonsense.
So some kind of collective responsibility, so genuine representation, if you like, rather than party representation, is a way forward.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, you know, I think in the social entrepreneur world, there are times when you would come together with other social entrepreneurs, and you would truly, it's the one time when you don't save face, you don't have the brave smile on, that you have to tell your board everything's okay, but inside you're crumbling, and you have to tell your stakeholders everything's going to plan, but there's hurdles left, right, and centre. I feel like in the world that, in the networks that we're part of, you can truly show an honesty and an authenticity, and you learn from each other's experiences. If we treated the running of global society like that, you know, if you truly mapped out what every country did well and used that as a blueprint or a guidance moving forward, so in countries where we see equality with any gender or maternity pay, you know, actually that focuses, maternity and paternity, that focuses on those parents being just good parents and that child growing up the best they possibly can. There's pockets of good policy across the world, yet there's too many egos to even admit that, oh God, if we want to duplicate their policy, we have to admit ours doesn't work. How can you fudge the numbers to show that ours is working? It doesn't work until we put our hands up and truly admit it doesn't work. And I don't think the current crop of global leadership, they've been raised on this learn how to spin it. Doesn't matter what you get asked, just say this.
Yeah, we
never move forward that way.
Yeah, I mean, there does seem to be, I would agree, a crisis of leadership. And you mentioned social entrepreneurs. Do you think social entrepreneurs are potentially the new global leaders? Is that the way forward?
Which country are you going to give me?
Actually, all of them.
No, but I think where a leaf can come out of the social entrepreneur book is we're purpose driven. There's going to be fundamental flaws in that because we're still trying to operate in a system where you have to beg, borrow, and steal to even get somewhere. You might have your mission and your vision, but 8 months of your year is fundraising to even move the dial along. So we're operating in a very, broken, fragmented society ourselves. But one thing's for sure is when you're driven by a purpose, and if that purpose carries a positive social impact, good things come from that. I don't think there are many leaders around the world that are driven in that way. We hear people talking about doing the best for their country, but it's very narrow and singular. You know, I mean, we've got a prime minister now that said, if you're a citizen of the world, then you don't understand what citizenship is. As if I've not got the St. George's Cross flying out my window, it's absolute nonsense. But that's our leader.
Yeah. There does seem to be a crisis in leadership. But then there, in politics, certainly. But then there are others around who people might say in the business world. So, you know, people like Bill Gates or whatever, or in the sport world. Do you think that they are potentially authentic leaders, or do you think really that there's a crisis of leadership just generally, in the world in terms of authenticity and value?
Well, in all honesty, I would probably say crisis generally across the board, because I often feel like, and I think to go back full circle to social entrepreneurs, we will try our hardest to produce the maximum output on limited resource. Then when someone tells me the good that Bill Gates does in the world, but I see the level of resource he's got, I'm often left feeling, well, we could do more. There could be more. People like Richard Branson, you know, now all this effort into taking us to space, but why are we not fixing the planet as we are now? It seems to me like the wealthiest people already know this planet's in for it, and the people, days are numbered, so they've got plan B going on. We're going to colonise Mars, and the elites will go and do what they will over there. I often look at the wealthiest, and not to take anything away from the good that they do, but we're talking about people with, in many cases, infinite amounts of wealth. Yeah. Yet we've still got hungry, we've still got uneducated, we've still got homeless, we've still got marginalised. I mean, it's ludicrous. So
what I'm trying to drive at here in the kind of constructive sense is we're the leaders, new leaders. If we are building this new ism, what you're saying is we need new leadership. So what I'm trying to get to is, right, where are the new leaders coming from? So potentially from social entrepreneurs?
It is
elsewhere.
But for me, it's, I don't know, I would like to move away a little bit, that it takes singular or small clusters of people to lead. I think one thing that we haven't done well enough is divide responsibility, so that actually communities lead, or people that share expertise to themes like, right, let's get the world's leading people that are trying to tackle this issue and bring them together to look at how they solve it globally, and resource added to that. I think there's room for this sort of, I know some refer to it as a bit of liquid democracy, so you find the thought leaders and they act on behalf of that community. So for example, yourself in terms of homelessness, you know, working with the others in the space but with the resource to do so. Me in terms of youth engagement in democracy, there's pockets of people doing this everywhere, but there's no resource for us all to truly come together to actually tackle it and look at what a new ecosystem looks like. And one big player is mass engagement. There needs to be majority of people, whether it's because they're under too much pressure or absolutely exhausted and can't even think about it, are just bust their balls in their job, if they've got a job, go home, replenish in whatever light way they can, go again. How do they come into the equation of saying, right, well, how do we solve climate change? How do we solve this? We need to move away from the reliance of singular leadership.
That's so interesting, because one of the themes that come out of the new ism really is that there are a lot of fantastic people doing really good work in particular areas of the world, and it's not going to scale, either because they're not connecting with other people or people just aren't learning and we're all in our kind of silos. What we're trying to do in this kind of newism is trying to bring people together and say, hey, this is potentially a new system here, and how do we all fit in? So the notion of moving away from individual style leadership into one of more collective leadership could be one of the kind of pillars or one of the values, if you like, of this newism, you think?
No, I do. And I think then that does boil down to some core fundamental values from the get-go. So what does education look like? What does it mean if we want this idea of collective responsibility, that we take responsibility for our individual communities, wider society, and indeed the planet? How do we best equip people to do that? Because a lot of us, and I think many social entrepreneurs, it's all self-taught. It's in many cases, it's repressing the pain that you feel that you've amalgamated over your life in one way or another, tuck that right down into the bottom of your tummy, and then dedicate yourself to a good purposes and use that negative experience of past trauma because I'm going to do good with it. Yeah. That's not sustainable either.
No.
These things need to be driven from a place of love, and those values need to be present.
Yeah. So education is a key area that needs to be sorted out and changed quite substantially globally.
Globally. I mean, it's the same. I think it's the same. It needs a whole new metrics. We can't, as for me, values of countries being placed on GDP is now as laughable as education being placed on how many A to C's a child got at school, or whatever the equivalent is globally. It needs to be equipping people ready to contribute to the world.
In a constructive way.
We've got so many broken parts in this country. I mean, colleges get paid now by the state for bums on seats. So they don't care if every single teenager from the local area comes and does a hairdressing course. They don't care that there's only one hairdresser in that town and most people are going to learn a qualification and then be jobless. They worry about their bit, which is get the bums on the seats, get the money from the state. It's completely broken. It's the same way with local councils. They're taught, if you've got any budget left in April, spend it or the government won't give you the money again. So we dig up every road.
So is that another area that needs to be fixed, you think, kind of the relationship between central government and local government? You know, I'm be interested in your views on where you see cities now. Interesting, you know, to think of cities as being there, as being leaders in the world rather than nation states. And, you know, if we're sitting here in London and, you know, Londoners coming together, doing their own thing, their communities coming together under a bit of leadership in London and then other cities around the world following might be an interesting notion. What's your view on where cities might be?
No, I ultimately think cities, if central government truly devolved power, And cities could shape what was best for that city, again, based on a set of principles, based on a set of values, then politics becomes a lot healthier because arguably you've got more chance of influence in local politics than you have national, yet we don't turn out in numbers locally.
So do you think, in terms of this new economy going forward, then localism is a key, another key part of this?
Well, you know, I mean, definitely don't want to become that guy that sort of coins these phrases, but it's glocalism, isn't it? It's global localism.
Yeah, well, you can't go backwards. Part of the challenge is you can't go backwards in time. We are global.
No, exactly. And
I think you can't pretend we're not here, so
no,
we are here.
Precisely. And I think for as many things we should celebrate about globalisation, in terms of interconnectedness, opportunities to truly see what's going on around the world, there does prove an opportunity there then to ensure that it becomes collective responsibility. You know, there's still too many parts of the world that haven't even got the basics.
Yeah.
And we could look to where cities are doing things well. Where are the best cities that are using renewable energy and how are they doing it? And begin to ensure those blueprints are in our emerging cities so that they're not doing this sort of, oh, we need to build back to build forward. There are parts of the world that are now just beginning to develop. So let's ensure we take the best examples so that they can move forward from the get-go and even leapfrog some of us that feel quite stagnant. I do love the idea of truly looking at where things are done well and where they can be replicated. And if we can learn to lose our egos in that scenario, then we definitely stand a chance. Local with a global view, not insular, not this idea of it's just us and we need to get it right. It doesn't matter if London becomes a fully sustainable city if other parts of the world are not and we're still churning up fossil fuels, because in the end we'll all collapse. So we can definitely try and encourage and involve as many people locally, but there needs to be a set of principles that we're going to follow globally.
So the world will be kind of open. You have to be open,
yeah,
I guess, and welcoming and learning would be some kind of values that you'd have in a city. Welcoming,
yeah.
And then actually sharing, I guess.
The sharing is a big part. I think we've become too conscious on borders and passports and things like that, and ultimately that argument needs to be shifted to you know, a division of resources where resources are needed.
Yeah, there seems to be a kind of contradiction in that particularly younger people, as globalisation has affected younger people who want to be citizens of the world, but then almost have a kind of identity crisis but want to be clearly from somewhere. There's a bit of a contradiction. But I particularly pick up from young people the whole business of passports and borders is something that they don't quite understand or particularly like, because they want to be citizens of the world.
Yeah. And
so then it's a question of how you balance that between being a citizen in the world and being responsible locally.
Yeah, or responsible wherever you are. So if I don't just refer to London as my home and the place where I'll recycle and be a good neighbour and help people that might be less more in need than myself, I can be that person wherever I go. But I often feel as though, well, you know, sometimes it seems to be this, as long as it's okay in my backyard, the other parts of the world are just, I'll be leaving soon, so...
Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You can throw the rubbish away.
But again, that boils down to this values, this education, this idea that you know, you can work to leave some part of you in this world, whatever that is. Like, leave a footprint wherever you go, be a good person wherever you go. And I do believe that in younger people that is key. This idea of this sort of global rethink of education, because fear and division is manufactured, and younger people, especially when children they're developing their values, that is the time, yeah. And it needs to be nurtured, but it needs to be nurtured in a way where parents have got the time to do it, so there's less pressure. Schools have got the freedom to allow curiosity to unfold itself. So it does fascinate me that there could be some small touch points that could start now.
Yeah, and presumably you as the social entrepreneur, you're always the optimist. I don't know a social entrepreneur that isn't an optimist. So presumably if you can get it right in some part of the world, then the obligation on social entrepreneurs is actually to magnify that and tell everybody about, hey, look, this is working, and then get other social entrepreneurs to copy it or franchise it or do it. Is that the way you see it?
Yeah, for sure. But equally, you know, I know some of the most successful projects now, especially internationally, is because I've been willing to collaborate and take the best parts of what other people are doing, combine it with the best parts of mine, and just allow the amalgamation to be concentrating on the outcome. Mm. And it doesn't matter if I don't own that bit, because actually we want the outcome. So you still need to maintain that openness to be like, okay, it works here, but I can't just assume it's going to work everywhere else.
Absolutely. I think more I was talking about the values. Absolutely. Because my experience of working with homelessness, It's the same issue, if you like, in every country in the world now, but it manifests itself slightly differently.
Yeah.
Therefore, the solutions are actually within that locality, but the overriding issue is the same. Okay.
For
so
sure.
if you take a view that actually in my world there shouldn't be anybody homeless ever, so how do you fix that? And then there are all sorts of things you need to fix that. It's not just about housing. It's about government policy. It's about employment. It's about education, as you say. But then it's a question of us learning from each other in that hopefully coming up with answers and then applying it locally.
Yeah, and I think, yeah, and I do agree with you, when social entrepreneurs do come together, we are driven by the outcome. So if everyone keeps that as their guiding light, it's wonderful to look at the different directions you could move in, as long as you're moving towards the outcome. And I do think there's such an amazing opportunity for social entrepreneurs especially to just at least be at the forefront for some of this thinking around, you know, what does a whole change to the ecosystem look like? In my eyes, if I look at the political ecosystem, I just see so many bits that don't necessarily need to be as complicated as they are. And I haven't necessarily got or proclaimed to have all the answers to fix it. I'm just of a rationale that if I can increase the amount of people that are willing to draw their attention to it, have a sense of values that, okay, this isn't working, And so I'm going to start to ask more questions and demand more accountability. The sheer volume of more and more people applying that pressure will have hopefully one of two reactions. Completely crumble the current system as we know it because it can't take this many people participating. And then from that, new people that are already engaged begin to start to say, well, this works, let's try this, this works. So it is around collective responsibility, or as many eyes on it as possible, as many people playing an active role, we'll hopefully see it start working.
Yeah, so for you, one of the key things is just getting people active and involved and a clear set of values. I'm interested in terms of the economy, because if we want to create a fair world, we want to create a fair economic system. Current economic system seems to drive money to money, and if you've got money, you're okay because more money will arrive, and if you haven't got any, it won't happen in the gap, right? Can you say? So the issue for me, if you're trying to create this fair society, where do entrepreneurs fit? Entrepreneurs are potentially, and usually are, disruptors. But they'll work out an angle to make some money to win the race, if you like. How do we harness that entrepreneurial attitude in a fair way? Because at the moment, entrepreneurs, it's just about huge, usually financial rewards for themselves. How do we change that mindset, do you think?
Well, That's the killer question, I guess. But I feel often quite disillusioned with this notion of entrepreneur and feel quite at home with the idea of social entrepreneur. Not to withstand the fact that we need to earn money to do what we do. But entrepreneurs, as you say, they're disruptive, they're innovators. If we can help them see a grander purpose than just the revenue, that could be a start. But as you say, this current construct, this current system is a race to the top, and if you reach a certain level, you're going to attract more, and once you attract that type of clientele, you open up to new markets. So I'm all in for this new blank piece of paper. I am encouraged by what some entrepreneurs are doing. Not to say that they're everyone's chasing the coin, mm-hmm. you know, because people that are becoming aware that as citizens we are becoming more socially aware. I think we need maybe a little bit more time to truly understand the sentiment behind people's behaviours, but we are seeing, especially younger people, and this might come from a sense of globalisation. If I remain solution focused and optimistic, you know, I do see them making choices about where they spend their money based on the supply chain of that person. I do see people boycotting big chains based on their behaviour. I do see people stop buying certain things based on how it operates and whether it pays its tax. So in many cases, I do think it can be driven as when we rethink the idea of who we are as consumers. If we can appreciate we're consumers, but first thing we are citizens, then that changes the dynamic. And business will always be demand and then supply. So if we can shift the dial on what the demand is, that starts with us as individuals, as collective. Then I think that entrepreneurial spirit will then just change course, because it will go to where the demand is and have to supply to it. And if that's built around a set of values or a certain way of doing business or a certain way of reinvesting your profits, then we will start to see that. But
that's really insightful and very interesting, I think. I mean, obviously, for a long time there's been discussion about, you know, fair trade and fair consumerism and so on, and the power of consumers, and that's worked to a degree. But I certainly pick up now that bigger businesses certainly are acutely aware of what they call the millennials. What do the millennials think? There's an immediate reaction.
They're petrified.
What do these millennials think? So, and as you know, everyone's kind of labelled, you know, these days even more. Kind of millennials is a kind of group of people who all think the same. But there's something in, I guess, what you're saying in terms of, you know, people power, or if you like, because if there's an awareness amongst a group of people, be they old or young or whatever, and they are behaving in a certain way in terms of products that they buy, that's very, very powerful. And entrepreneurs and new entrepreneurs coming to the market will change their behaviour accordingly. And that's very powerful. That's probably, I don't know what you think, more powerful in terms of change than lobbying government.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the two can go hand in hand, because if you can lobby government where those entrepreneurs can get more support to drive these businesses, you know, whether it's tax breaks for the demonstration of the impact or whatever it is, you know, it'd be wonderful if government could complement and accelerate that. But yeah, we hold so much power as a society. I just don't. I really don't think we've understood it. And I know social media can be criticised in many ways for some of the negative impacts it's having, but it does almost feel as though at the click of a button that it could completely shift, but it has to come from people. It is simply just another mechanism to communicate. What we're communicating boils down to us. What we're interested in boils down to us. And I always bring it back down to this, you know, children especially, if they grow up with this sense of social purpose, empathy, compassion, not being afraid to get proximate to the disengaged, the marginalised, the disabled, the incarcerated, to see the injustice for what it is, to better understand it for what it is, and then take those experiences to try and change it, then we're in good hands. But our current construct is petrified of giving power to people, because it understands the risk. It would change life as we know it.
So really, one of the key things moving forward in the newism is we need a power shift, more to individuals and communities, to allow them to have their decisions which affect their lives in immediate terms.
Yeah, and ultimately, you know, one of the beautiful things is we don't have to wait to be given this power. We can take it. It is essentially ours. And I think the work of many people in the space of youth empowerment, engaging the disengaged, empowering the disenfranchised, does boil down to providing these people with experiences where they understand that they've got a lot of power collectively, and what they and then inspiring them to just be curious about what they could do with it. And I do, this is happening. Not at the rate we need it to, and there needs to be a point in which the top and the ground up find a middle. But I guess that's definitely, you know, needs to be drawn out in this idea of a new ism that you're exploring, because sometimes I look at the world I find myself in and think, well, actually, if that was just done and everyone was truly educated and engaged in this, then we wouldn't need to think about some of the other stuff, because it does become collective. But, I could talk for hours on it, I guess.
Yeah, I would say that this whole discussion that you're talking about is really fascinating. And that there's people like us, just the social entrepreneurs, who are looking for the newism. And a lot of the issues that you're talking about are fundamental to it. That the new economics is absolutely vital. The economic system does not work, and it's part of the big problem. So the values that underpin this newism are vital, and you've been talking about them. I just have one kind of final question. I have lots of questions, but I'm one final one. It's just about the whole issue about, in this global world, this challenge we have between big and small. You know, you can almost see a kind of self-sustaining economy on a Scottish island somewhere, where, you know, the hens lay the eggs and we eat the eggs, and we have this kind of enclosed little economy going back in time. As against these, you know, in the UK, we've heard about supermarkets amalgamating to create super supermarkets, huge shops, to drive down price. And everybody's kind of going, oh, that's okay. Where do you think we should be around this kind of small and bigness? Because to me, again, it's a value about how we live, who we know and who's employed in the shop.
It's such and the example you give there, the value of supermarkets, supermarkets, it's a monetary one, not a wider community one. And I actually don't. I sit and I agree with you, you know, and I sit here quite openly as contradicting myself. But I despise supermarkets. I use them, but that's partly because I'm limited on time and I'm probably quite lazy and I don't shape my life in the way.
So like many people.
Yeah,
this is a challenge, isn't
exactly.
It becomes, what you're describing is how we
shift our mindset. Yeah, because
that's I'm the same. So it's that's the same. What we do.
But I don't see it as going back.
How do you change your behaviour? I mean, I think you're really onto something there because that's us, and we're, we're committed people to kind of create some change, and yet we in a sense play our role in creating society that exists. How do you change that? That's the key thing, isn't it? How do we change our lifestyles? We just got to be not lazy,
collective accountability. You know, we're often, we can't disregard the power of social referral, and many of us will change our behaviour if others are, and maybe we need the people to kick things off, but it's I don't know. I mean, the most fascinating thing is the bravest person isn't the first person on the dance floor. It's the second
person, yeah,
and maybe it's is this notion that if I know Mel's committed to no longer using supermarkets and ensuring that we keep the local economies booming, then I'll do it because I feel the pressure next time he asks me.
That's a deal then. Listen, fabulous talking to you. Thank you very much. We're just at the beginning of this whole discussion about the newism. We want positive contributions. You provided some.
I hope so. I feel like I just rambled a bit, but
no, not at all.
Nice.
And part of the thing, Mike, I think, is that for all of us, this is a challenge.
Yeah.
I mean, there's lots of good things going on, microfinance, fair trade, etc. But they're not connected. We know there's something there. We all know this system isn't right. We have to live in it, so we buy food from supermarkets. That's what exists. But we're struggling to just get down on a piece of paper what it is we're all trying to do, and I think we're having an attempt at that. Let's see what happens, but it's just part of our lives. And then after this interview, we go back to the day job and struggling on to get our own social mission accomplished in our organisations. But that's because we're social entrepreneurs, so that's the way of it. But I'm very grateful for your time. Really great talking to you.
Thanks, Mel.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on Mel and Michael's conversation and on what Michael thinks it will take to create a new, fairer economic system. Please do get in touch on Twitter at newismtalks or via our website, newismtalks.com. Next week, we'll be talking to John Elkington, a world authority on corporate responsibility and sustainable business. We do hope to see you there.